On this week's 51%, the House has passed the SAVE Act, which would require proof of U.S. citizenship from anyone registering to vote in federal elections. Could it make it harder for married women to vote? We'll speak with the director of Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics.
The types of documentation that are required are really overly burdensome.
We'll also learn more about civil rights icon Elizabeth Freeman, who is set to become one of two women to be honored with a bust in the Massachusetts Senate chamber. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Just before our last episode, the House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act. The bill, which has been pushed for by President Trump, would make a number of changes to the voter registration process. Among them, it would require anyone registering to vote in a federal election to present documents proving U.S. citizenship. That can include your birth certificate, naturalization papers, a U.S. passport, or perhaps the new Real ID. Advocates of the SAVE Act say it will prevent voter fraud, but opponents note that millions of Americans don't have easy access to these kinds of documents. And what if, like many married women, your last name no longer matches the name on your birth certificate? Debate around the bill has spawned a lot of fear that this could end up restricting women's right to vote. So how worried should we be? We've lined up a couple experts to help us learn more about this bill today, starting with Dr. Elizabeth Maddow, director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Dr. Maddow, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Jesse.
Of course, we're happy to have you. I thought maybe to start off, you know, let's talk about what this bill would actually do. So what does the SAVE Act entail?
Okay, so the ostensible purpose of the SAVE Act is to guarantee that only those who are eligible citizens, are voting on Election Day. So, you know, I'd really begin by saying that that is a noble goal. That is something we should all want to be sure that the people who are voting on Election Day are eligible voters. And the way that this is done with this act, and it's called the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, or the SAVE Act, requires individuals to provide documentary proof of their citizenship in order to register to vote. Now, again, on its face, that shouldn't seem problematic. It's worth noting, though, that there already are laws in place requiring people to be legal citizens, to be eligible to vote, as they're registering, as they're going to the polls. One of the challenging things about voting in the United States is there's a lot of variety between states. So states do this in different ways, but it is certainly already a feature of the way we hold elections. The reason that this act has been getting some extra attention is that the types of documentation that are required in order to document or to demonstrate proof citizenship are really overly burdensome, are more burdensome than they've been in the past. And the concern is that it's going to be particularly burdensome for portions of the populace, whether it's lower educated, lower income potential voters, people who move a good deal, women also. So the purpose of it is to make sure only those showing up to the polls on Election Day, only those registered to vote are citizens. But the requirements that have been added really will end up burdening to an unnecessary degree people from actually getting to the polls on Election Day. So that's what the concern has been.
And I just want to make sure I'm getting all of the documents here that would qualify. So we've got passports, we've got your birth certificate, we've got naturalization papers and real IDs, which are new starting next month. Is there anything else that I'm missing there?
Well, the thing that I want to really amplify here is although those will satisfy as demonstrations of being a citizen, they may not be sufficient. So, for example, if people are showing a birth certificate that demonstrate that, yes, they've been born in the United States, they're a citizen of the United States, they also need to show a photo ID that matches the information contained on that birth certificate. So there are some forms of identification, like a passport, that will have everything you need. You will satisfy all requirements for the SAVE Act. Not everyone has a passport. And folks who are listening, I'm not sure the last time you got yourself a passport. It takes a little doing. You need to, make your way through the system. It can be done. There is a cost associated, but not everyone has a passport readily available. And also, not all driver's licenses have all of the information that you need. There's some what are referred to as enhanced driver's licenses that provide both proof of identity and US citizenship, but not every state has those. So it's important to remember it's not just something that demonstrates that you're a citizen, such as a birth certificate, but also something that also matches with your photo. And so it's, a few extra requirements that aren't already in place. And again, it may take a little extra skill. It may take a little bit of extra navigating the system in order to get all of those requirements. And that ends up burdening particular segments of the populace. It's really worth mentioning the reason why this is interesting, different from previous pieces of legislation is the ways in which it could burden women in particular. Because when you show your birth certificate, it will have the name that you were born with. But then you also have to show a photo ID that matches the information contained on your birth certificate. So if you've changed your name over the course of your lifetime, it's going to make it even harder. And as we know, most of the people who have changed their name throughout their lifetime are women who have gotten married and then taken on their husband's name. So it's an additional burden.
Yeah, if you're a married woman and you don't have that ID to match your birth certificate, like what are your options from there?
Right. And so you would be one of those people who, if you have a passport, if you've updated your passport, I remember when I got married and had to change my name, I had to go and update my passport. So, if your passport is updated to reflect your new name, that would satisfy. Or if not, you'd have to go and update your passport, or you'd have to find a way to get a real ID, one of these enhanced driver's licenses. But it would just add more time, more burden. I think the thing to keep in mind, and it's worth sort of saying at the outset, in the United States, unlike comparable democracies, more often than not, the burden is on the individual to get themselves registered to vote. There are now more and more states that have automatic voter registration. More often than not, you're registering at the last minute. There's a deadline that you need to meet. So if you don't know ahead of time, if you haven't built in some time before the registration deadline to get all of this documentation, you could be ineligible to register for that election. So again, it is something you would likely be able to register eventually, but given that it may take a few extra steps, that could slow some people down and keep them from getting registered for an election in question.
Yeah, especially, like passports can take months for those things to come through. So.
Absolutely. There are ways to do it online, but again, that assumes that you have the ability, they have a computer, that you have an ability to really navigate the system. And, if someone doesn't have the resource of time, doesn't have the resource of, the educational skill to navigate that system, that might slow you down. It might thwart you from going through the process.
You mentioned that even the way we do things today can differ from state to state. Can we expect to see something like this implemented differently from state to state as well?
Well, I think the purpose of this, unlike, it's been very difficult to pass federal legislation. And the purpose of this SAVE Act, passed by the federal government, is to try to have a uniform system or at least uniform requirements nationwide. And so, in that way, it does provide a little bit of uniformity in ways that we don't have that much uniformity when it comes to voting in the United States. But certainly, there are possibilities and some of the threats that have been identified in particular by the Campaign Legal Center has done a lot of research on the SAVE Act and particular ramifications of the SAVE Act. And what they've indicated is that it could potentially, when implemented, could result in the purging of voter rolls in particular states. And so you may see certain states engaging in, taking people off of their voter rolls who shouldn't necessarily be purged from their voter rolls. You may certainly see a variety in the extent to which it's enforced from state to state. But I think the thing that's unique about this act is that it is meant to provide some uniformity.
I'm glad you brought up the voter roll purges, because I think this act would make it more frequent, those kinds of purges. Are there any other major changes aside from, now having to have this proof of citizenship requirement that we should know about?
Well, I think the other thing that is a real potential threat is the ramifications or the burdens that are placed on election workers. And in many ways, it includes some fines, even imprisonment, for election workers who are registering voters incorrectly, do not follow all aspects of the SAVE Act, and or if they actually ended up registering a voter without documentary proof of citizenship. Even if this person turned out to be an eligible citizen. And so I think it casts in a moment where sort of election workers, which are really on the front lines of democracy, at a moment where they've been facing real threats in recent elections, it adds sort of one more burden on election workers that not only, is there the chance that they accidentally make a mistake. And more often than not, these mistakes are accidental, not purposeful, but they may even face a fine. They may even face the threat of imprisonment. So I think that's another an element of this to be concerned about.
Now, this hasn't been passed by the Senate yet. How soon can we expect them to pick that up? And does it have a likelihood of passing, do you think?
I would not be surprised if it is fast-tracked. I mean, it is something that certainly President Trump has placed as a priority. He even issued an executive order that is quite similar to this in the last week or so. And so it went through the House very quickly. I would not be surprised if it comes up before the Senate fairly quickly. It will be difficult, but not certainly not impossible, but it will be difficult for it to pass in the Senate. There are very few tools that Democrats have available to them right now, given that they are in the minority in the House and Senate. One is the threat of a filibuster. So it will require, given how slim the lead is for Republicans in the Senate, so it will re require 60 votes to keep from having a filibuster. So that would mean you'd need some Democratic senators to come on board. I think it's unlikely that we will have them, that you'll be able to garner enough Democrats to support it. But we are in a moment right now where there is a lot of focus on not only the safety of elections, but also concerns about those who do not have legal status, not only in the United States, but engaged in elections. So there is a sentiment right now where there might be some support, but I would be surprised if there were enough Democrats that were willing to support it at this moment in the Senate.
Well, thank you so much just for taking the time to speak with me on this. Is there anything that you think voters should be doing in the meantime to prepare in case this goes through?
Right. I think the use of the word prepare is a good one. Something we are always telling our students here, but it's really worth reminding all voters, is that it is valuable to make a plan to vote. And often that requires really doing your research, making sure you really know what your state's voter registration practices are, what their election day practices are, because they do change. And sometimes they change in a way that makes it easier to get to the polls. So, for example, perhaps your state has enacted early voting. Perhaps your state has enacted same-day voter registration. I'm in New Jersey, and those are some practices, that have been advocated for. We don't have same-day voter registration yet, but we do have early voting. So it's always worth really making sure you've reviewed not only what are the practices, but what are the requirements? What are the deadlines that you need to be mindful of? And so I think that's a good practice in general. I think in particular at this moment where we are seeing legislation being proposed and sometimes enacted at the state level, is particularly important. You know, I would end really with sort of the obvious statement, but that voting matters. It is, there's a lot of ways in which you're, you know, we can be informed and engaged and participants in democracy. Voting is the pillar of representative democracy. And it's only a representative democracy if our electorate is representative of our populace. So we want, you know, we want those who are voting on election day to reflect the population. If you're eligible to vote, you know, we want you at the polls, but it may take a little bit of preparation and some research ahead of time.
Dr. Elizabeth Maddow is the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. You can learn more about her work at eagleton.rutgers.edu. Dr. Maddow, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the Center for American Progress estimates the SAVE Act would impact roughly 69 million married women in the U.S. who, as Dr. Maddow just explained, would have to make sure they have a passport or some other citizenship-proving ID with their new last name and not their so-called maiden name. There's another aspect here we haven't touched on yet. Under the SAVE Act, you would have to register in person rather than online. I spoke with Greta Bedakovics, Associate Director of Democracy Policy at the Center for American Progress, who worries this could especially impact rural women.
People generally don't realize that for like one township or one county, you have one election office. You might have even just one election official or maybe a very small staff, but that means a lot of people are going to have to drive very far to their election offices to show this documentation during business hours, which can require taking time off of work. And a lot of people are already thinking to themselves that they're already registered, so this bill is not going to impact them. But we know that 80 million American citizens every federal election cycle, so every 2 years, either register to vote for the first time or chiefly update the registration information. And for all of those folks making those updates as well, they're going to have to take a physical trip down to their election office to show these documents. We've also seen some data showing that in like very large rural counties in the U.S., including ones in like Arizona and Utah, California, even Idaho and Oregon, there are voters who are going to have to drive between 5 and 8 hours round trip just to get to their election office and show this documentation in person. And I think we're hearing from a lot of people who support this bill saying like, well, you know, I have my documentation. This isn't going to be an issue for me. But we're really trying to get people to realize that even if you have all of your documentation in order, even if you don't have to pay for additional documentation, you can no longer do this online. Like, you're going to be getting in your car in a lot of instances and driving 8 hours, taking a full business day off of work just to get in line at your election office now and show your documents if you, you know, moved across the street and have to update your registration. Or, for example, if you got married and again have to update your registration to reflect now your currently legally married name.
Yeah. And when's the last time you went to a government office and actually, you know, like got out at a decent time?
I've been joking too, like we already know kind of Americans hate going to the DMV, and there's been so many DMVs that have started doing more digital transactions in order to make the process simpler. And now instead, we're basically sending election administration, you know, back 2 decades and making all Americans go in person. And if you think about, you know, very large cities as well with millions of registered voters, you know, an election cycle, if everyone's trying to update, I mean, you're looking at a handful of election officials who are going to have to, you know, in person see millions of people and approve all of their documentation. I mean, we're going to be seeing, you know, chaotic lines and just it's going to functionally overwhelm election offices.
So if this passes, and the president has his own executive order on this too, just to the sidelines here, you know, do you foresee there being lawsuits over this?
Absolutely. I think we'll absolutely see lawsuits from officials, including in many states, many county election officials as well. I think one of the biggest, you know, claims that people have to make is that this is essentially a poll tax on elections, right? So if you don't have one of the forms of documentation, if you don't have a passport, if you don't have a birth certificate because you lost your copy, or if you lost a copy of your marriage license, something like that, all those documents cost money. And so that is a direct poll tax on voters. There's no way around it. And there's also no funding behind this bill to, for example, help people pay for documents. I think the one interesting thing about it too is that the executive order doesn't even list, for example, birth certificates as a way to prove citizenship. So if the executive order is not blocked in the courts, you know, we're already seeing legal challenges. It's really actually only going to be a passport that the majority of Americans can show to prove their citizenship status. So there's a direct cost on voters, a poll tax, which is unconstitutional under the 24th Amendment. And so I think we'd see a lot of legal challenges based on that. I think something also concerning is that in states, for example, like Arizona, which kind of experimented with state law similar to the SAVE Act around proof of citizenship, they actually kind of had to like bifurcate their election system. So they have separate voters registered for state elections and separate voters registered for federal elections. And because it's a federal bill, if states still want their voters to have full access to state elections, they might similarly try and separate their voter rolls. And so, that could introduce a lot of uncertainty as well, where if you haven't shown documentation, you could still be allowed to vote in a state election, but you couldn't be allowed, for example, to cast a ballot for president or Senate or Congress.
Okay, so all of this is supposed to combat voter fraud. I'm curious, what data do we actually have on how common voter fraud is?
Yeah, voter fraud as an overarching category is still extremely uncommon. I mean, President Trump even established a whole presidential advisory commission during his first term to study voter fraud, and it disbanded after the commission was not able to find any proof of wide-scale voter fraud. And similarly, Representative Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, even said following this past presidential election cycle that he had no evidence of non-citizen voting or voter fraud, but that it was just intuitive that it was happening. And on the basis of that intuition, they're trying to pass laws that are going to overturn the way that every single American citizen registers to vote. But I think it's also critically important to, for example, you can look at data from the Heritage Foundation, where after they studied 40 years of elections from the 1980s to the present, they were able to uncover 41 instances of non-citizen voting, right? So this bill is not just trying to get around election fraud. It's simply trying to stop, in their words, non-citizen voting in elections. And so over that course of time in 40 years, 2.3 billion ballots were cast by American citizens, and the Heritage Foundation was able to uncover only 41 instances of purported non-citizen voting. And so by any measure you take it, that is basically 0.000% of all ballots cast, but 2.3 billion Americans cast ballots during that elections. And so, this is just a bill in search of a problem, as many people have said it, but it's just going to cause catastrophe for American voters.
Greta Bedakovics is the Associate Director of Democracy Policy at the Center for American Progress and its expert on the SAVE Act. You can learn more about her work at americanprogress.org. In Massachusetts, a Berkshire County icon is set to become one of two women to be honored with a bust in the state Senate chamber for the first time in its history. WAMC's Josh Landis reports.
When it comes to pomp and circumstance, the Massachusetts General Court, originally founded in 1629 and formalized as a modern state legislature in 1780, has been in the game longer than most.
The Massachusetts Senate chamber is directly under the Golden Dome of the State House. So if you've ever been down to Boston and you see the State House building with the giant gold dome, if you were to follow it directly, it would lead down to the chandelier that hangs over the Senate chamber and features the ceremonial fish, the holy mackerel.
Democratic State Senator Paul Mark of the Berkshire, Hampden, Franklin, and Hampshire District.
Traditionally, it was the House of Representatives chamber, and then hundreds of years ago, it became the Senate chamber. And so it is actually the oldest legislative chamber in the country where legislation still happens.
The State House itself was officially completed in 1798. In many ways, it still reflects that sense of antiquity.
If you look around, there's these empty spaces, and in, I want to say, six of the empty spaces, there is a bust right now of some gentleman from history. For the first time last year, I believe it was, we added for the first time a person that wasn't white. We added a bust of Frederick Douglass. And so the Senate formed a special art committee dedicated to figuring out who were we going to put into the chamber to be the first woman represented in this historic building.
Four finalists were presented.
The Senate voted to include Elizabeth Freeman in recognition of the work she did to effectively end slavery in Massachusetts under the Constitution of 1780, and also to add Abigail Adams, who was the wife of John Adams and was an advocate for the inclusion of women in the Constitution and in the Revolution and in the founding of our state.
Elizabeth Freeman was born into slavery in upstate New York before being taken to Sheffield, Massachusetts to live as the property of a white family. She paved the way for abolition in the Commonwealth when she successfully sued for her freedom, citing its newly passed Constitution in 1781. The house she lived in is now a historical center, and Sheffield put up a statue of Freeman in 2022. Last year, Boston-based family history center American Ancestors announced it had successfully identified Freeman's first living descendant and brought her to Berkshire County to see her famous forebear's former home. WAMC checked in with Lisa Shepperson about news of Freeman's selection for the statehouse bust.
I am very excited. I am very proud to be her family. I am who she is, and she is who I am, and I've said that before in the past, and I mean it even more now.
Shepperson lives in Richmond, Virginia.
Through the statue, I believe that her leadership as a black woman and a black slave would go on and on beyond me, beyond my children, and for the younger generation of the Berkshire County.
Massachusetts marks Elizabeth Freeman Day on August 21st, a celebration Shepperson wants to see expanded.
I am hoping for the legacy that it would go on to other states that are unaware of who she is and what she did and where she came from. I want it to go further and further. I'm bringing it here to Virginia. I have some connections here that they'll be here in Virginia, and I hope to have Elizabeth Freeman walk here and in every state on Elizabeth Freeman Day. So the legacy lives on. It's going to live on through me and through my children. I'm trying to educate them.
Freeman is also the first person from Western Massachusetts to be recognized with a bust in the chamber. Again, Mark.
I think it's also important, maybe from just a personal point of pride for those of us in the Berkshires, it's also going to be the first person from Western Massachusetts represented in the Statehouse Senate chamber. And so, yeah, I think it stands for equality. It stands for freedom. It stands for diversity, and diversity making us stronger.
The Senate Art Committee's next task is to select an artist to create the likeness. WAMC asked Mark if he thinks one might be chosen from Western Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah, that would be amazing. I imagine they'll consider maybe even the people that worked on the Elizabeth Freeman statue, or the people that worked on the Susan B. Anthony statue, or the people that are working right now on the W.E.B. Du Bois statue. I mean, we have a lot of amazing history reflecting our rich culture in the Berkshires, and yeah, it'd be great to try to also advertise how do we get someone from Western Massachusetts, or at least someone that we know has come through with really amazing works in the past, to make this happen. I think it would be a great touch.
Reporting from the WAMC News Berkshire Bureau at the Beacon Cinema, I'm Josh Landes.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little